When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and Talkspace, the leading virtual therapy provider, is encouraging people to talk it out in therapy. By talking or texting with a supportive, licensed therapist at Talkspace, you'll gain insights, discover truths, and experience breakthroughs that will improve how you live and how you feel. With Talkspace, just answer a few questions online, and you'll be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, whenever you feel most at ease. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members only pay a $25 copay or less. No insurance? No problem. If you want to make progress toward a mentally healthier place, Talkspace is here for you. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Welcome to Gospel Tangents Podcast. I'm Rick Bennett. In our next conversation, we're going to talk to Dr. Matt Harris of Colorado State University, Pueblo. We'll talk about the one drop rule. How is it that Mormons determined blackness, especially if there were biracial families? We'll also talk about a Supreme Court decision in the 1960s that legalized interracial marriage. Check out our conversation. Before you do that, I just want to mention, please remember that our latest books with Dr. Simon Southerton, as well as George Potter, both on the Book of Mormon, are on sale this week only. It's a special deal. So if you go to Amazon.com or check us out on our website if you'd like to download it, it's just $6. So this week only. Now back to our conversation. I know that there's a quote, and in fact, I remember talking to Paul Reeve about this, and he said, well, you got to be careful with that because it's not the best source. Where Wilford Woodruff had written in his journal that Brigham Young had said that a man can't have one drop of African blood. Mm-hmm. Although, from what I understand now, that's not an exact quote. We need to be a little careful with that reference. But I know that and you're a big U.S. history guy too. So there was a talk about the one drop rule, even in with regards to slavery. Is that something that kind of morphed into the LDS Church, and you couldn't have one drop of African blood in order to get to hold the priesthood as well?
Yeah. So after the Civil War, yes, after the American Civil War, there's this big push among, especially people in the South, to preserve bloodlines, and racial purity is really what it is. And after the Civil War, there's a number of states pass miscegenation laws preventing not just black people marrying white people, but also Asians from marrying whites and so forth. So it's not just, you know, blacks and whites. So one of the purposes is to preserve the bloodlines, the purity of the bloodlines. And so they pass these miscegenation laws. They also pass, they make other moves. The eugenics movement will take off after the Civil War, trying to take people who have, as they put it, inferior genes from reproducing. And not surprisingly, they'll target black people, not wanting them to reproduce, particularly if they have a low IQ and so forth, or if they have some kind of, I guess they called it mental retardation in those days. We don't use that word today, but that's what they were talking about. So there's this eugenics idea that you don't want people with inferior genes to reproduce. And also that after the American Civil War, the courts, both state and national courts, will codify this quarter one Negroid drop rule, which is to say that that if you have one quarter Negroid blood in you, then you're considered African American. And what's interesting about this is that depending on the state, these laws are very fluid in the early 20th century. And I tell my students, I teach civil rights, so we talk about this. We discuss a book called Loving v. Virginia, which is the Supreme Court case that removes, it strikes down these miscegenation laws, declares them unconstitutional. This is 1967. But anyway, what's interesting is that in the early 20th century, these miscegenation laws are very fluid. One state might say, well, it's one quarter. Another state might say, no, one eighth or one sixteenth. And I joke with my students sometimes that on Monday, a black man can marry a white woman because they fit within the parameters of the law, but then they change the law on Wednesday and now it's no longer constitutional. And so when we say race is a construct, this is really what this means, that the government's defining what these bloodlines are. And the church is going to follow some of the most common of these court decisions, which is the one-quarter rule. That seems to be the most prevalent around the turn of the century. And
so just to make sure, mm-hmm. So if you're one-quarter black, then you can't marry a white?
That's correct. Okay. Yeah. And the church will follow those prevailing patterns. And so church leaders will tie it back to previous leaders. You know, they'll ultimately, I don't know if Paul Reeve shared this with you, but ultimately a lot of the leaders in the 20th century will tie it back to the prophet Joseph Smith. Mm-hmm. There's no evidence for that the ban began with him. I mean, in fact, in 2013, with the Race and Priesthood document, it's the first document anywhere that the church produces where they lay the ban squarely at the feet of Brigham Young. And Joseph Fielding Smith and other church leaders had said that the ban began with Joseph Smith, and that was the sort of the common line. But the truth is, there's no evidence for that. And scholars over the years have pointed that out. But nonetheless, these church presidents and other leaders thought that the ban began with the prophet Joseph Smith, but that's just not what the evidence bears. And then the Priest and Priesthood document doesn't support that position. So, and we know from the scholarship that Brigham Young is the person whose presidency creates the ban, because there were several men who were ordained to the priesthood under Joseph Smith's tutelage.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think there are still some people that want to tie that to Joseph Smith. Have you seen anything like that, especially like in anti-Mormon circles or anything?
You mean the priesthood ordination to the prophet?
To put it on Joseph instead of Brigham. Because it seems pretty clear from the priesthood essay that it seems like it started with with Brigham Young. But a lot of people feel like, hey, we're throwing Brigham under the bus. And a lot of people would love to throw Joseph under the bus, especially critics of the church.
Well, I have to confess, I don't read anti-Mormon. So I don't know. I can't answer that question. I just don't read that stuff. But it wouldn't surprise me if people tied it back to the prophet. And I mean, why wouldn't they? Church leaders had taught that for so many years. And even LDS manuals to this day still teach the ban, at least the manual I saw a year or two ago, tied the ban back to the prophet.
To Joseph.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
It's just a matter of cleaning up the manual and creating a new edition. That's
They've
all
been reading, doing these manuals for 20 years. I think it's time for an update.
Yeah. That's all it is. I don't think it represents, strange to say this, it doesn't represent the current views. It represents the views of 20 years ago when the manual was created.
Right.
But the church has definitely evolved in its understanding of the ban and with the prophet versus Brigham Young.
Well, and I should ask Paul this question, but I'm going to ask it to you since Paul's not here. So I know, and I don't know how familiar you are with the work that Paul has done, but I know that Paul has said we need to be careful about using the Woodruff Journal, because in the journal it does say one drop in there. I believe this is in reference to Brigham Young's address in 1852. Paul says that when you actually look at the transcript, which I think he's actually working on a documentary history for the Utah legislature of 1852, the word one drop does not exist in there. So that seems like Wilford kind of inserted that into the record when Brigham Young didn't actually say that. But I guess my question is, even if you say that that's a misquote from Wilford Woodruff, does it seem reasonable that even as early as, say, 1852, Mormons were using this idea of one drop as a reason to deny blacks the priesthood?
Well, you know, it's always an interesting question about when one leader says something, does it constitute the church teaching, the church direction, the doctrine of the church? And of course, with Brigham Young being the very powerful leader that he was, it's so different today in the way we create doctrine in the Mormon Church. The first presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve will agree to it and vote on it and prayerfully consider it. But in those days, when Brigham Young spoke, he spoke. And, you know, from my reading, the one-quarter rule doesn't really emerge in the Mormon lexicon until after the 20th century.
Oh, really?
This is when you start to see, probably late 19th century, you see B.H. Roberts and certainly Joseph Fielding Smith and Bruce R. McConkie, where they start to really hammer home this idea that if you have a quarter drop in you, then you're disqualified from the priesthood. And I see the evidence of that in the 20th century is overwhelming. And the question is, when does it start in the 19th century? And Wilfred Woodruff does say it in the 1850s. Simply doesn't mean it's an accepted church teaching at that time. But for me, the evidence really picks up probably with B.H. Roberts around the turn of the century. And I don't think any Mormon leader really questions this in the 20th century. And in fact, I would argue that in 1852, they're still trying to work all this stuff out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a nice piece of scholarship out there that the ban, one of the reasons for the ban is that Brigham Young was upset that one of the early black brethren were marrying into polygamy without permission. And he was just revolted by that.
Yeah, Warren McCary,
yeah. And that's where we get some of the tough statements that Brigham Young makes about interracial unions and interracial sex and so forth. So, but anyway, this messiness is unfolding in the 19th century, and it really becomes accepted in the 20th century because when Mormons start to talk about it, Joseph Fielding Smith and some other leaders, you can see a parallel with national trends after the Civil War. It's not surprising, at least in my view, that as Americans are talking about the one-quarter Negroid rule, Mormons are following this rule as well. And so that's what I would feel comfortable saying about the quarter rule. It's hard to know when it precisely started, but it's certainly around the 20th century.
Okay, so into the 20th century, you're saying that if a person had one quarter black blood, mm-hmm. basically a grandparent, right?
Correct.
Then they could not be ordained.
Correct.
So do we have somebody that says, well, my great-grandparent, could they be ordained?
Well, that's interesting. It depends on who you ask. You know, one of the things about this ban, and my work tries to point this out in this next book that I'm doing, is that I really want folks to see how this policy, this ban, it's both a temple and a priesthood ban, how it plays out and affects real-life people, both people of color, black folks, white folks, and also church leaders, too, some of whom can't reconcile the justice of Christ with this difficult teaching. And then there are some other leaders who have inherited it uncritically, and they don't really ask the hard questions. Is this really something we ought to be doing? And why are we denying our black brothers and sisters these privileges? And certainly they read the scriptures into it. Mormon leaders, they're not unique in thinking that black folk were cursed from Cain, the biblical counterfigure. And of course, by the turn of the century, there's a new rationale for the priesthood ban, which is that they were less valiant in this premortal existence. This is uniquely a Mormon sort of thinking. But the whole curse thing is very Protestant in notion, and it goes all the way back to the ancient world, to be honest. So anyway, Mormons inherit this Protestant dogma, and they just inherit it uncritically. They don't ask about it. And if we can just jump ahead for a moment, one of the things that a junior apostle in 1978, Elder Haight, David B. Haight, he said something interesting. He said, you know, when we overturned the priesthood ban, you know, none of us just ever really asked, is this the right thing to do? We just inherited it from our predecessors, and we just continued it. And I thought that was a pretty revealing statement by Elder Haight, that, gosh, maybe this wasn't the right thing to do. And so, obviously, President Kimball and Elder Haight was part of that process. Mm-hmm. So. But yeah, a lot of these racial views will emerge from the larger American society. And you'll see, really, truthfully, and I mean this respectfully, but you'll read some of the leaders, Elder McConkie and his father-in-law, Joseph Fielding Smith. I mean, it reads just like a Southern Protestant clergyman when they're talking about, you know, segregation and civil rights and so forth and the curse of Cain. I mean, really, in my view, there's no distinction with some of these sermons if you juxtapose them. So Latter-day Saints, again, they're not unique in some of these beliefs.
Okay. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Matt Harris. In our next conversation, we're going to jump back to the 1950s. Did you know that President McKay considered lifting the ban as early as the 1950s?
Elder Bennion writes his report to President McKay and tells him that there's no scriptural justification for the priesthood ban. And this is 1954, I should say. And so so President McKay contemplates lifting the ban, but he recognizes that it will cause hardship among the saints in the South. Keep in mind, this is still segregated America. So if he lifts this ban, it's going to create hardships among Latter-day Saints in the South.
Thank you so much for listening. Make sure that you like our page on facebook.com/gospeltangents. You can subscribe at YouTube at youtube.com/gospeltangents. We're also on Twitter at Gospel Tangents, as well as make sure that you subscribe on iTunes so you don't miss any of our episodes. Thanks again for listening. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here you'll see some more of our videos. Thanks again.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.